Hello everybody, welcome back to another Journal Club. For the following 3 weeks, I have recorded 3 Journal Clubs on closely related papers. The papers are essential for my own graduate program at Vanderbilt University. The project that I'm currently working on aims to understand the effect of the length of daylight on positive emotions like pleasure, motivation, and reward. And there are multiple cellular and molecular pathways involved. We know some of them, and I will describe them in the following 3 episodes. There's also a lot that we currently hypothesize, and for now I'll refrain from presenting those hypotheses. But as we know more and publish our work, I'll update this journal club and inform you of the developments. The project that is a collaboration between 2 Vanderbilt primary investigators, Brad Greeter and Douglas McMahon. And the papers have the 2 as primary investigators. The first paper that I would like to share with you today was published last year in eNeuro, which is the Journal for Society of Neuroscience. And the first author is Alexis Jameson. Alexis is my predecessor. She was the one who worked on the project before I joined the Greeter Lab. The title is Photoperiod Impacts Nucleus Accumbens Dopamine Dynamics. As always, let's break the paper down by talking about the individual terms in the title. The first term is photoperiod. Photoperiod is the scientific term to describe the length of daylight. For example, it is summer now here in Nashville and we have beautiful weather. Along with this weather, the days are longer. So today the sun rose at around 5:30 in the morning and it's expected to set by 8:10 p.m. That is a total of 14 and a half hours of daylight. And the photoperiod in this case will be 14 hours or 14 and a half hours. The opposite of this is in the winter when the days are shorter and the nights are long. So in winter, the photoperiod might be as short as 8 hours. This change in photoperiod is something that we experience with seasonal changes across the year. But in addition to observing it, most living things, including plants, respond to this change in the length of daylight. For example, reproduction in some plants is accelerated by specific photoperiods, and the length of daylight could be a major cue to perennials, signaling the time of the year and cueing their reproduction in the form of flowering and seed formation. This reaction to photoperiod is also observed in animals, which is a topic for today. In humans, we experience seasonal changes in many ways, including the length of daylight, and our brain can sense this difference and react in ways that we may not be aware of. You see, we detect light with our eyes, and particularly, we have a special kind of light-sensitive cells in our retina. Our retina is the nerve tissue in our eyes. And in the retina, we have what we call intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. These cells detect the presence of light and signal to a region of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. This region of the brain is the master clock in the body. It is responsible for the synchronization of all our circadian rhythm. Circadian rhythm is a very popular concept that is often mentioned in popular science. And you may have heard about it already, but just to avoid any misconceptions, I'm going to describe what it is and why it is important in the context of photoperiod. Circadian rhythm is a natural oscillation in multiple body processes over a 24-hour period. Most of the processes in our body have a daily pattern to them. One easy example would be sleep. We often sleep in similar durations throughout the day. If you regularly sleep between the hours of, let's say, 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., then your body follows a natural 24-hour rhythm for sleep, and you start getting tired right around 10 p.m., and will be able to wake up without an alarm right around 6 a.m. So sleep is a very easy example to give because we all experience it and we can observe it. Other body processes like body temperature, blood pressure, glucose metabolism, fat metabolism, hormonal systems, all of these have a 24-hour rhythm. And it all boils down to the expression of the genes that are involved in these processes in a rhythmic pattern over the 24 hours of the day. So if there is some cyclical expression to these genes, then the processes that these genes are involved in will also have some sort of rhythmic pattern. And this pattern that I've been referring to is kept in almost all body cells in the form of cellular clocks. For example, we can think of liver cells as having cellular clocks for glucose and lipid metabolism, because most of the glucose and lipid homeostasis happens in the liver. We can expect to have cellular clocks in liver cells. However, all these cellular clocks are synchronized by the master clock that I mentioned earlier, which is the suprachiasmatic nucleus. This brain region receives input from our eyes about light stimulus in the environment and uses that input from our eyes to synchronize all the body clocks. We take this for granted because we're not aware of it as it happens in the body. But this is what allows us to predict and adapt to seasonal changes. That's how our body knows what time it is in the year. And to put this into perspective, if there were no clocks and calendars, and humans had no way of counting days or measuring time throughout the day, our bodies will still know what time it is in the day and what season it is throughout the year. So this is a very impressive system, and it gets me excited every time. Now, alongside this perception of seasonal change with length of daylight, we also observe seasonal changes in mood. You may have seen people using SAD lamps, S-A-D, which are these really bright lamps that people use in the winter months to reduce seasonal affective disorder. What they're essentially doing is lengthening their daylight and tricking their body into detecting a longer photo period. I think that's an amazing approach to treat seasonal affective disorder, which is a term to describe the negative mood that people experience during seasonal changes as our bodies take time to adapt to the new season. But at the same time, clinical reports also show more mood disorders like anxiety and depression in a season-dependent manner, especially in the winter months when there is shorter photo period. Now here we can go on multiple tangents and talk about specific mental health disturbances and their relationship with the time of year. But that is a topic on its own, and we may bring it up in future journal clubs. But for today, I'm going to take your attention to one symptom that people often describe when they're having a negative affective state like depression. People often describe a loss of interest and enjoyment in the things that they used to enjoy. These activities used to be a source of pleasure for people, but during an episode of depression or some sort of seasonal affective disorder, the activities are no longer pleasant and rewarding. The experience of pleasure and reward could be mapped to multiple brain regions, but for today we're going to focus on the most popular pathway for pleasure, which is the dopamine system. We've talked about it in previous episodes of this journal club, and I think it would come back many, many times again. Dopamine is another famous term in popular science. It feels like everyone is talking about it now, and it's a neuromodulator in the brain that is closely associated with reward, motivation, and addiction. And this system is large and touches multiple regions, but for this journal club, let's focus on the nucleus accumbens. The dopamine neurons project from the ventral tegmental area to the nucleus accumbens, and these are two regions in the brain. The source of dopamine is the ventral tegmental area, and the release site is the nucleus accumbens. And the nucleus accumbens is a brain region that is associated with motivation and reward-related emotional processes and behavior. Scientists who studied dopamine in the nucleus accumbens studied dopamine dynamics. Dopamine dynamics is a term used to describe the release of the neuromodulator, its reuptake, its effect on nucleus accumbens neurons, and basically what happens to dopamine and the nucleus accumbens. It's an umbrella term to describe all things dopamine at the synapse between the projecting axons coming from the ventral tegmental area and neurons and other cells of the nucleus accumbens. And dopamine is released from axons at the nucleus accumbens, and some of it makes its way to dopamine receptors on other neurons in the accumbens. And another way of clearing that dopamine is by sucking it up back into the axons where it was released from. There's a transporter protein called dopamine transporter that shuttles dopamine from the synapse into the releasing cell so that the dopamine is recycled and could be released again. It's very important to transport the dopamine back into the releasing cell. Otherwise, we end up depleting the dopamine stores that we have. In fact, one of the ways that cocaine affects our brain, and specifically the dopamine system, is by blocking the dopamine transporter and interrupting the reuptake of dopamine back into the releasing cell. So it's essential to reuptake the dopamine and replenish the releasable pool. I'm going to stop my brief intro to dopamine here because there's just a ton to say about dopamine, and I happen to work in a lab that studies dopamine dynamics, and I can go on about it and there would still be a lot left. And there's also a ton that I do not know about dopamine dynamics in the nucleus accumbens. With that said, I have already told you about seasonal changes in the length of daylight and reports of negative mood disorders associated with seasonal changes. I have also briefly introduced the dopamine system. I'm nudging a speculation here. Does the shift in photoperiod affect our reward and motivation pathways in the brain? That's one question. Does the length of daylight affect our dopamine system? And is that biological? Is there a biological reason why we lose interest in activities that we normally enjoy? And that is the question behind my project, finding the cellular and molecular mechanisms behind the length of daylight and any associated changes in reward and motivation is what I study. That is a very long introduction to the project and also today's paper, but I think it's important for any future journal clubs, including the two that will follow today's episode. Now with that, I'll go ahead and describe today's paper, and I'll first start describing how the experiment was actually conducted. It all starts with the mice. The most popular mice used in laboratory studies are the C57 black mice. This mouse strain has lost its ability to produce melatonin, which is the major hormone that signals our sleep and our circadian patterns. Therefore, we had to look for other mouse strains that we could use for our project on circadian rhythm. The mice that we use are the C3HF++ strain. The C3H mouse strain produces melatonin, so it's melatonin proficient, and could also be used for photoperiod experiments. So these mice were housed under different photoperiod conditions. The mice are bred and kept in these light-adjusted boxes where their exposure to light could be artificially controlled, so we can keep them at different light durations. There were three photoperiods. The first is the short photoperiod, which mimics winter-like days. There's 8 hours of light and 16 hours of darkness. The second photoperiod is the equinox, and this condition has 12 hours of light and 12 hours of darkness. The last photoperiod was the long photoperiod, which resembles summer days, with 16 hours of light and 8 hours of darkness. I'll say that again. The first photoperiod condition is the short photoperiod, with 8 hours of light and 16 hours of darkness. The second photoperiod is the equinox condition, with 12 hours of light and 12 hours of darkness. The third and last photoperiod was the long photoperiod, which mimics the summer days, with 16 hours of light and 8 hours of darkness. The mice were bred and grown in the specific photoperiod until they reached adulthood, which is 8 to 12 weeks. And once they reached this age, they were then sacrificed and their brains were sliced so that we can study the part of the brain that has the nucleus accumbens, because that's the brain region that we're interested in. The coolest part about all of this is the technique used to measure dopamine dynamics in the nucleus accumbens. Alexis used a technique called fast scan cyclic voltammetry, which is a cool technique of measuring the oxidation of dopamine at an electrical potential. And I'll describe how this works. So the brain slice is placed on a slide, and there's a stimulating electrode made of carbon fiber that comes into contact with the slice. And using this carbon fiber electrode, we can quickly vary the electric potential in the slice. And so when the voltage changes, dopamine gets oxidized and reduced in a matter of seconds. During this really fast process of oxidizing and reducing dopamine, there's a change in alternating current, and that change will be picked up by the recording electrode. So there's another electrode. And from that change in alternating current, we can calculate the exact amount of dopamine that is found in the synapses between the dopamine axons and cells of the and other neurons of the nucleus accumbens. It's just a great technique to ask questions like the amount of release, the reuptake of dopamine, and other questions of dopamine dynamics. That is the technique for today, and now let's talk about the important results from this paper. The first result that we observed is that there is more evoked dopamine release in the long summer-like photo period. So Alexis used a range of stimulation frequencies on that carbon fiber electrode and found that the mice from the long photo period condition had higher dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. The mice, I'll say that again, the mice that were exposed to 16 hours of light had higher dopamine than the other two photo period conditions. And there was no difference in the release of dopamine between the short photo period condition and the equinox photo period condition. And after seeing this, Alexis differentiated the data between male mice and female mice. Sex contributes to a lot of differences in the regulation of dopamine, and we have known about this for quite some time now. And we see that in figure 2 of this paper. When the data were classified based on sex, we see that photo period or the length of daylight significantly affects dopamine release in female mice and not male mice. I'll say that again. The length of daylight does not affect dopamine release in male mice. However, female mice, and more specifically female mice raised in summer-like photo period, which is the long photo period, have higher dopamine release than other female mice that were born and raised under equinox and short photo period conditions. In fact, just as in figure 1, we see here that there is no difference in dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens of short photo period and equinox photo period female mice. So we see here that long photo period is correlated with higher dopamine in the nucleus accumbens of female mice. That is just one part of the story in figure 2, because if we analyze the voltammetry data to measure rate of dopamine uptake in the nucleus accumbens, we see that this dopamine uptake is higher in female mice that were raised in long photo period. I'd like to take you back to the idea of dopamine uptake. After dopamine is released in the nucleus accumbens, one of two things will happen. It can either bind to receptors in the target neurons of the nucleus accumbens and carry out its neuromodulation function, or if there's any excess dopamine, there is an uptake process that transports it back into the cell body for either recycling or degradation. And so the rate of uptake is an important aspect of dopamine dynamics and could be measured using the technique that I described earlier, voltammetry. And what we observe in this study is that female mice in long photo period have higher dopamine uptake than equinox and short photo period mice. What we learn here is that there is higher release and at the same time higher uptake in female mice under summer-like conditions of daylight. And the rate of release and uptake is not dependent on the length of daylight for male mice. So there is a strong sex-specific effect here. As I've said earlier, one of the clearance mechanisms for dopamine uptake is the dopamine transporter. Think of dopamine transporter as a pump that sucks up dopamine from the synapse, and activity of this dopamine transporter determines the rate of dopamine uptake in the nucleus accumbens synapse. synapses. In figure 2, we learned that long photo period increases the rate of uptake of dopamine in female mice. Now, the next step in identifying the particular mechanism of dopamine uptake is to see how photo period affects the activity of the dopamine transporter. And that's what Alexis did for her third experiment, which is presented in figure 3. It's the same experimental setup, but as she is recording dopamine dynamics with voltammetry, she added a drug that inhibits the activity of dopamine transporter. The drug is called GBR12783. There's no need to remember the name, but this drug binds to the dopamine transporter and blocks the reuptake of dopamine in the synapse. This leads to excess dopamine staying in the synapse, and that could be recorded through our technique, which is fast scan cyclic voltammetry. As you would expect, the inhibition of dopamine transporter was more sensitive in the long photo period female mice. In panel C, we have a plot of concentration of the inhibitor versus the apparent Michaelis-Menten constant for dopamine transporter. And we see that there is more dopamine transporter inhibition in long photo period female mice compared to the short photo period and the equinox conditions. So we learn here that the length of daylight affects dopamine transporter function in female mice. And again, I have to mention here that this photo period effect is sex specific and we do not see it in male mice. Those were the results from this short paper. We learned that long summer-like photo period increases dopamine release and uptake in female mice. Before we finish for today, I would like to mention some of the limitations and strengths of this study. To start off, we learn a sex-specific effect of photo period, and that is important because we know from clinical reports that seasonal mood disorders are more prevalent in women. More women are diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder, so we can make the inference that the dopamine dynamics is more light-sensitive in females. These sex differences could be due to the effect of sex hormones during development and the different phases of the female reproductive cycle. With that said, there's also a major limitation to this study. Unfortunately, all of this data was collected at a single time point during the day, so we do not capture any rhythmic pattern that would be typical of a circadian system. We might be capturing the highest point in dopamine release and uptake in female mice, and missing out on all other time points, so we never get to see the decrease. At the same time, the single time point might also be the reason why we are not seeing any photo period effects in male mice. And of course, the project is going on and we're learning more about it. But for now, I would like to leave you with these questions in mind. And I promise to provide more answers in future journal clubs. That's it for today. As always, you can check out the episode notes for the PubMed link to the paper. I'll also add the links to the lab web pages of the McMahon and the Greater Labs so that you can see more of our work. Also, be on the lookout for more episodes next week because there are two other papers from this project that I want to share with you. Until next time, ciao, ciao.